I can't imagine those emotions that go into hearing that diagnosis, and thinking, what do we do now? So how did and you talked about just trying to maintain the normalcy of everyday life, but what are other things that people can do to move forward in this new journey?
Yeah, so for us, it was, we went through a trajectory, which I think is common. We hear it a lot with married couples, that in the beginning, whether it's the man or the woman that might have something going on, it's never originally thought of as being, some type of long-term cognitive decline. It manifests itself in other ways. And in my case, and in many cases, for Ginny, it manifested itself in behavior and attitude and personality. And so, there became kind of an edge to her. She was always a very kind of hot-blooded Italian, but it became amplified in a way that wasn't like her normal self. And so we started out by going to marriage counseling. And, because we thought, I thought, actually, I drove it. She was like, well, I don't need this, But I drove it because I was like, no, there's something wrong. She's upset with me or she's upset with our situation. And it wasn't her usual self. And that went on, for probably a year, 6 months to a year, before the family therapist, marriage counselor said to me and to her, but really pointed at me, which was, there's something more going on here. And you need to, Jenny needs to see somebody in addition to coming to see me or us. So then it became, seeing a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist, really couldn't grapple with it as well. And then it became evident one night when we were out to dinner, and we had been to this restaurant about a month prior, and we sat at a table, and I met the hostess. And so when we went in the second time, I said hello to the hostess by name, and my wife said, how do you know her? And I said, well, we were here about a month ago, and I remember asking her name, and she goes, well, I've never been here before. You must have been here with another woman. And so that was kind of the start, and I was like, wow. And so alarm bells went off. And so when it came, when ultimately things started to progress, Ginny, although she wasn't happy about going to see a neurologist, it took about a year to go from the general practitioner to a neurologist. But ultimately, once we got that diagnosis, which took another year after that, so we're talking like a span of 3, 4 years before we really knew what was going on. And Ginny was told, you have a progressive form of dementia, and we don't really know, we can't say for certain that it's Alzheimer's, but we do know that it's progressive, and we do know that, it's going to continue because we've been tracking you for this period of time. She turned to me and said, okay, well, where are we going to lunch? And that was it. And that was the last time she ever really heard anything more about it. She just decided that, she was going to go forward, and I agreed with that. And so we had always traveled pretty extensively, but that, within a week's time, I made plans, and we went to China. And after that, we went to India. And after that, we went to Egypt. And after that, we went to Ireland, and that was her last trip. We went to Sweden as well. So we went, you know, I just made the decision that for as long as she was physically able, we were going to, you know, go to wonderful places and see wonderful things and be social and get out with other people, and that's what we decided to do, and we did it.
So it's important to focus on what they love, what their passions are, and help them do those things until they're unable to do them.
Absolutely. And Jenny was loved to travel. She was a phenomenal skier, and she would go all over the world skiing with her ski club. And, you know, it became impractical for her to go with the ski club. At one point, she was just not able to be left on her own, and that's about the time when, you know, I said, "Well, I'm going to go. We'll take you, and we'll do it." And that's what we did.
Mm-hmm. Now, did your family did they take the same thought that you all did, that the two of you did? Were they just side next?
Absolutely. Yeah. No. When Jenny and I got married in 1982, right, we got married in 85, but we met and were a couple in 82. She had two children. So at that point, I had not been married. So I've never had kids of my own, but I had her two kids.
Mm-hmm.
And they were phenomenal. I mean, although they were not around to help because they had moved on with their lives, and they were adults, and they'd moved out of the house some time prior. So they weren't local. They couldn't help, and they just, you know, it's not that they wouldn't have helped, but they couldn't.
Right, right. Yeah.
But they loved the fact and supported the fact that, you know, we went everywhere and did everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you continue to work after her diagnosis?
Yeah, I continued to work up until Jen's last year of life. So I worked up until September 2013, and she passed away a year later, about thereabouts.
Mm-hmm.
But I continued to work. And the challenge was that, you know, we started out in the mid-2000s with a care giver agency coming in like twice a week at night to help Jenny make a meal.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became every night that I was away. And then they would stay overnight. And that went on until I would come home. And then I hired somebody to actually live in our house, and I refitted the house so that there was kind of an apartment in the house, which, you know, was fine with me, and the person lived there, and that went on for about a year and a half. And then the problem became that Jenny was still not safe, you know, even though we had somebody full-time in the house, and even though I would be in the house many times when I was home, as I traveled, you know, one night, Jenny was going up the steps of our house, and we have like a turn, you know, like a landing and turn and go up, and she fell backwards and dislocated her fingers and fell, and her jammed her fingers and dislocated them. And so I was like 10 feet away from her when it happened, and I'm like, I put her fingers back in place,
mm-hmm.
and but she couldn't express her pain,
right.
Except, you know, she was, I know that she was in pain, but, you know, she had no way of communicating with me at that point. And I made a decision right then that, you know, no matter how much I loved having her at home, and that's where I would have hoped she would have been able to stay. She needed to move to a place with 100% care.
Mm-hmm. And you never regretted that decision?
Not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all, because the challenges can be many when somebody is living at home. I mean, it can be such that somebody's able to live through the end of their life. But that's typically when there's a compounding problem. You know, if there's heart disease, if there's diabetes, if there's cancer, there's some other compounding problem, or they're just, you know, they're on in age, where living to the end of your life with dementia is possible in your house. But Kinney was still young enough, in her 60s, and quite frankly, she was in perfect physical health.
Mm-hmm.
So the issue really became one of what's going to be the safest for her and for everybody else concerned, because quite frankly, when I was with her at home alone, one of my concerns was that I would have, there's a lot of stress. So, you know, that I would have a heart attack, or I'd fall off a ladder.
Right,
or,
right. You know, she couldn't be there.
Something would happen to mm-hmm. me, and then she wouldn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so she probably would have just sat there.
Right.
Mm. You know. And so she couldn't make a phone call. She couldn't speak an intelligible sentence at that moment, at that time, at the end of her, you know, as the, you know, she could speak some garbled messages, but, and I kind of understood what she was saying, but, you know, she would never have been able to communicate to a neighbor about me.
Right.
And she probably wouldn't have known to go get somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. so it was her safety, my safety, and also there's quite a bit of anxiety when you're kind of like locked in the house. So no matter how much we got out or how much, you know, we could go out with her, and, you know, she was at risk for, you know, leaving, you know, and walking out, and she wanted, you know, the age-old issue of wanting to, quote-unquote, go home, that she would, you know, she would bolt, you know, if the door was open.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of anxiety for her. So, not, you know, let alone me and the other caregivers that I had coming in. So, you know, she would get frustrated and she would, you know, get angry. And it's all because, you know, she wanted to go to whatever place she felt was home. So, in the end, although it was a tough, it wasn't that tough a decision, because once I mean, it was tearful and it was heart-wrenching, but once I got her into the community she went into, a weight was lifted off her shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
And although she still had some anxiety about being there in the initial stages, it evaporated quickly, and she was a very social person
mm-hmm.
always,
mm-hmm.
and so she immediately took up walking with a bunch of women and talking and jibber-jabbering with anybody there, and they loved her there, and, you know, it was wonderful.
Uh-huh. Sounds like she was thriving there.
She absolutely thrived there, and, you know, in the end, it was always tough to leave her because she'd want to come with me, but, you know, she really didn't verbalize that I was her husband anymore, and so it became easier and easier, and the one thing that I can say is I always, 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 even in the early stages of her condition, I always spoke positively with her about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, you know, once the diagnosis had been made, I knew there was, And I knew prior to that, but it certainly triple confirmed that there was no need to argue with her about anything. And that was going to get me nowhere, and it was only going to frustrate her. So I immediately took the position that everything was wonderful and everything was great, and smiled at every chance I could with her. And it changed her. I mean, she just took to that.
Mm.
And so, you know, we talk about, hey, isn't this great, you know, food's great, this is a great place, isn't this cool, and we go out, and, you know, isn't it wonderful today? And she would just beam. And even when she was anxious, you know, all you had to do was say, I called her Ginny Jin. I would say, Ginny Jin, this is, isn't this phenomenal? This is great. And she would just smile, and all of a sudden, you know, she was no longer anxious.
Well, and it kind of takes me to this next question, too, because I'm sure one of the things that played a big part in helping her find some happiness and joy in every day was you guys used non-medical treatments, correct? Like art,
yes.
And...
Well, yeah. I mean, I did light therapy. So, you know, there's seasonal affective disorder is a common disorder with lots of people, but, you know, it's basically lack of natural light.
Right.
And I actually got a light machine that was made for that purpose of supplementing your vitamin D, kind of giving a natural light. But I would get her outside for natural vitamin D exposure. You know, I would I'd get her outside as often as I could. You know, we would. She was ultimately in a wheelchair after a couple of years, and you know, we'd spin around the parking lot, and we'd sit outside for an hour and just, you know, let the breeze, you know, hit her face, and she loved it. And she couldn't say anything but very brief, kind of a yes or no, but I would ask her, isn't this wonderful, Ginny? And you know, I have videotapes of her in that situation, and she would just smile and look at me, and you know, just kind of put her face to the wind.
Yeah. So you created and founded the Dementia Society of America after she passed, correct?
Yeah, not after, before.
Before.
I started it in the same month that I left my corporate job.
And why did you decide to start it?
The issue for me was that, and I still believe this to be true, and we really are kind of one of the only all of dementia's organizations. In other words, we don't focus on a niche or form of dementia.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't focus on Alzheimer's alone. We don't focus on Lewy body, frontal temporal dementia, CTE, stroke, Creutzfeldt-Jakob. There's so many forms. And there are organizations that do, right? So there are organizations, both national and local, that you know, really specialize their work in a niche form of dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they fundraise for, and that's how they spend their money. They spend their money to cure or to attempt to cure or to find research, more research to do. And we look across all forms of dementia, more or less equally. And we recognize that there are some major forms of dementia. Alzheimer's is one, vascular is another, Louis Bonney and Frontal Temple are two other big ones. But we don't discriminate. We kind of take all calls as if, you know, they're the same. And yet if we know that there's been a diagnosis of a particular form of dementia, or somebody has a question about a particular form of dementia, then we'll supply information that's specific to that form.
Mm-hmm.
The other big difference is there are volunteer organizations, but they're generally small and not, they're devoted to kind of niche needs, such as support groups or people living with dementia themselves. So there are a number of organizations, two or three relatively good-sized organizations that deal with people, and their members are people with dementia.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times, those organizations are dealing with younger onset dementia, because these are people in their maybe 40s, 50s, and 60s that, you know, are having to leave work or, you know, are still working, but they want a place to have support and, amongst fellow, you know, people that have dementia. So that's not our role. That's not what we do. But we are probably the largest. In fact, I think I could say we are the largest all volunteer, all dementia organization in the U.S. and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So other organizations exist, that's no doubt, but they have a pretty heavy paid staff. You know, it's heavily loaded with a lot of staff. So those people are paid, and that's not a bad thing, and they do good work. But we took the position that we were not going to have paid staff. We were going to try to do everything through volunteers that we could.
What difference is DSA making in the lives of people, do you think?
Yeah, so, well, I tons of difference in a lot of different ways. The number one thing is that we're not a niche organization.
Mm-hmm.
We're not a subtype of dementia organization. That makes such a huge difference to most of our constituents. And the reason is, well, first of all, dementia is still an unknown to a lot of people. So people don't understand the differences between dementia and Alzheimer's, or how dementia and Alzheimer's relate to one another. So, because Alzheimer's is a bigger brand name, I put that in quotes.
Right.
And a lot of it has to do with Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
Ronald Reagan is said to have had Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
But, so the issue is this. You have an organization like, let's say, the Cancer Society. So the Cancer Society represents all forms of cancer. But you also have organizations that are more narrowly focused, such as on breast cancer, or skin cancer, or leukemia, or testicular cancer, or unique and rare types of cancer,
mm-hmm.
liver cancer, and so forth. So, not that liver cancer is rare, but I'm just simply saying that, you know, that there are rarer cancers that have kind of like these subgroup nonprofits. If I had testicular cancer, I would not necessarily look to support or information from the breast cancer organizations that exist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the same way that because dementia is still, in some cases, cannot be 100% diagnosed as a particular type of dementia, people oftentimes, with their general practitioners and others, just get a dementia diagnosis. And they can't pinpoint it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Alzheimer's cannot be definitively confirmed until after death.
Right.
So, and there are people, in fact, today I met a woman who came to me at a meeting today and told me about the fact that she had had hypoxia but had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
Huh.
And it took a couple of years. She was put on Namenda, she was put on Aricept, but yet by addressing her sleep apnea, which was almost like addressed kind of, oh, by the way, her cognitive impairment improved to where now today she's, you know, working and living a full life.
Right.
So what we're trying to do is not pigeonhole or rubber stamp people into a particular diagnosis. That's not our job. And we, in fact, find a lot of people are misdiagnosed or feel they're misdiagnosed, but have been told they have Alzheimer's by their general practitioner when a general practitioner is not qualified to give that diagnosis. So we believe that on a very personal level, we're providing a tremendous service to the, you know, American public to encourage, you know, getting, you know, a really good neurological workup if there's an issue. And then we put people in touch with local resources that are more specific to what their needs might be. So if somebody comes to us that has a Lewy body dementia diagnosis, which can be fairly well established, we're not going to send them to the Alzheimer's Association.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to send them to the Lewy Body Association. Same with frontal temporal. Same with vascular and stroke. Same with Wernicke-Korsakoff, Creutzfeldt-Jakob, and others. CTE. So we're really focused on getting people to the right place with the right resources, whether it's local or national. And we're not afraid of pointing people to another nonprofit that can do the, you know, can be more specific to them.
Mm-hmm.
If they absolutely positively feel that they need Alzheimer's support, then of course we're going to send them to an Alzheimer's support group or the Alzheimer's Association or another organization that is an Alzheimer's organization, and there are many besides the Alzheimer's Association. So we, you know, we're going to put them in the right place and try to, you know, at least give them some options.
Well, what are your hopes for? Are there cures in sight? What's research showing? Are we ever going to be able to see an end to this terrible group of diseases?
Well, so Julie, I mean, I think that the jury is way out on this one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's been over 100 years since Alois Alzheimer first saw the neuronal tangles, the dead tangles of neurons, and the beta amyloid plaque, the sticky plaque residue that is built up in the brain tissue. And he saw that, and he did not, at that time, believe that what he was looking at was a disease. He didn't know what it was. And so people have been looking at this condition for over 100 years, and hundreds of drugs and research trials have been done with little to no effect. So I think we are where cancer was maybe 50 years ago. And it was the C word.
Right.
And now we're talking about the D word, dementia.
Right.
And so my belief is that there are some things that have been studied and have much clearer impact than any particular drug that has come along so far. Of course, it'd be great if there were, like, the killer app, right?
Mm-hmm.
To kind of coin a phrase.
Yeah.
And maybe there will be, but, you know, billions of dollars have been spent with no real results. So I don't put our donors' money into that type of, into the heavy into research. We do support research in various forms of dementia, but it's not our focus. And our focus is more on the things that can be very effective in the moment. So what does that mean? For people living with dementia, it's the arts. It's ways of communicating that are not necessarily verbal. Because those verbal skills go pretty quickly in some forms of dementia. And so we want people to be able to communicate and share and be creative. So music, making music, listening, singing, you know, all of those things, music appreciation, live music, recorded music, all good. We, you know, lots of music therapy studies prove that out. It's really good for the brain. We know it's good for us as humans because when we get a great song on, we smile, we dance, we move our feet. So we know that there's a response. And it's at the very heart of who we are as humans.
Mm-hmm.
Art is the same thing. Being able to, you know, creatively produce a piece of artwork, talk about a piece of artwork or photography, you know, just enjoy being in the presence of beauty and art. And, you know, so those things are also known, right? We know that people are awed and inspired by creative acts. So, and movement. So we're big into movement. Whether it be, you know, sit-down yoga or whether it be dance, appropriate dance, ping pong, table tennis. We're big believers in table tennis. It's one of the best protective sports out there, low impact. And then touch. So we're looking at, you know, the power of touch. You know when somebody holds your hand or pats your shoulder, rubs your back, you know how powerful that can be. So those are things we're doing that we know that for the future will work for us as humans. The other area, and this has been proven out in a study called the Finger Study, which was a study done in Finland, completed in 2016, and there's follow-on studies. But it's all about lifestyle choices. So, you know, if we can't stop the onset of a dementia necessarily, what can we do to delay or improve the chances of lowering the risk of getting a dementia, having dementia while you're living? That's all around environment and you know, we are what we eat.
Right.
So the mind, the diet, the Mediterranean and the DASH diet combined. Mm. It's also education. It's exercise. It's learning new tasks. So things like language, trying to speak a new language. So all of those things are apt to lower one's risk for dementia. So really, when we talk with people about our organization, we always focus on two things: dementia awareness and education, and brain health. And those two things together, you know, are how we move forward.
Right.
At least, you know, for the very foreseeable future. So it could be another number of years before we have a medical solution, but it's probably going to mirror what we have in cancer today, which are specific DNA or genetically based solutions. They call them immunotherapies, where everybody is unique and their therapy will end up being unique. So there's probably not going to be a one pill solution. There's probably going to be a multi-modality solution.
Right.
And drugs and other, you know, medical therapeutic interventions are probably going to be customized to who we are, and that's a long ways off, but they're going in that direction.
Right.